Accession number 30284, reel 8.
Right, next bit, reel 8.
There was one episode which you might find interesting when we were attacked by a British aircraft. I was flying with Percival at the time, and we were coming back from an operation, a daylight patrol. And we were coming back to base, and a skua approached us and opened fire on us. And I flashed with my oldest lamp, RAF, but this skua flew away. We didn't, the gunner said, shall I fire at him? Percival said no. And anyway, we came back to St. Evelyn and landed. And there, in front of us being debriefed, was a young fleet arm pilot. And he was giving an incredible account about how he was attacked Heinkel approaching St. Evel. And we listened to all this story about how he thought he'd shot down this Heinkel. Percival was a Canadian. He had a very forthright manner, I'm afraid, for this poor pilot. We were next being debriefed and explained how we were attacked by a skua. And this chap was looking at us with open mouth. And Percival said to him, I won't repeat exactly what he said, but take a running jump at a rolling donut, he told him. But it wasn't exactly those words. So that's one amusing thing which happened. But he never hit us. He definitely fired at us. Anyway.
Was he claiming that the Heinkel had been shot down?
He was claiming a victory with the Heinkel that he'd shot down. I mean, the fact is we flew away from him, you see. We didn't reply. We flew away from him. And I suppose we went down low over the sea to shake him off. And he thought he'd got us, I suppose, but he didn't hit us at all. But to see the fellow who was a very, very young and, I think, inexperienced fleet arm chap, I think he was a sub-lieutenant or something like that. But he was in the briefing room just in front of us when we landed, talking about this episode. We let him do it. We let him carry on for quite a long time before we chipped in. We were in the debriefing room, and he was there explaining about this dramatic episode. But I never heard of this phrase about what you should do with a rolling donut. But that was apparently a Canadian phrase that he used. Anyway.
Was there ever the threat of night fighters?
Yes, the night fighter episode, I have rather skipped over that. But on three occasions we were, night fighters had a go at us. One of them was with our normal pilot, Jack Percival. And this occurred when we were flying, I think, on the way to Saint-Nazaire with a full bomb load. And my role, of course, was to work on the chart, to some extent try and find the wind velocity, and also to keep a lookout in the nose. I had a particularly advantageous position in the nose. I could not only see in front of us, but underneath us as well. And I may have said before, I had very good night vision. Suddenly on our starboard side, I saw an orange light coming towards us. It was on our left. It was coming towards us across our, towards more or less at right angles to us, but getting nearer and nearer to us. And I knew about night fighters, and I don't know why, but we knew that they did have an orange light in the nose. What it did, I'm not quite sure. We also knew, of course, that they had what they called Schlager Musiker, I think my German's correct here, jazz music, which is upward firing guns. So they try and get under the belly of another aircraft and have a go at us. And I said to personal navigator pilot, looks like a night fighter coming on our left, on our port, and underneath us, coming nearer and nearer. And there was a great clank as we came out of automatic pilot. We had an automatic pilot, and we were flying 1,500 feet off us, and Percival got right down over the sea. And he thought we should have bought the raid. Maybe he was right. Anyway, we did abort the raid, and this thing, this orange light, kept circling around, and I could still see it. And we had a little gadget called a Psycho, a coding machine in the navigator's position, a handheld thing, with a lot of parallel slides in it, all with letters and numbers, and you had to slip a card in, altered day by day, and to a datum line, and the datum line read the message you wanted, and you read the decoded message from the top of the slide, from the top of the slides, and gave that to the wireless operator, and I put returning to base, chased by night fighter, ETA so and so and so, and that got back to base. And we flew back. It was by this time, it was dark, of course, and occasionally seeing this light. And I had an argument with Percival on this occasion because, as I say, I had pretty good knowledge of the heavens and the firmament. And there was a planet called Arcturus, and he thought that that was a night fighter, and I couldn't dissuade him that that was the planet Arcturus. And he didn't think I had that kind of knowledge anyway, I suppose. But I did, and it definitely was Arcturus. But this is the interesting part, that we landed safely, and we had also a device which you may have heard about called IFF, Identification Friend and Foe. And we'd always switch this on when we came back to base, so that obviously they'd know we weren't an enemy aircraft. And they plotted us coming back, but they also plotted another, which didn't have an IFF. And this was obviously the night fighter following us. And then they had a report that the night fighter, or a German aircraft, had crashed into the cliffs. And although I can't definitely prove it, nor can anybody else, this aircraft, definitely German aircraft, did crash into cliffs, as sometimes our aircraft did too. You know, off the Cornish coast, those cliffs were steep and dangerous, and you had to be very careful about them. And he was possibly keeping us on his radar, and he crashed into the cliffs, it would seem, and they were all killed. So that was one episode with night fighters. We landed, aborted the raid, came back with our bombs. It probably was the right thing to do. We possibly, if we'd carried on, it would have shot us down. The other occasion occurred when Percival had to... Well, he'd married a very pretty English girl and lived in married quarters, but he had sinus trouble, and he had to have a minus operation on his sinus, which took him away for about a week or 10 days, something like that. So I was left, and so were Reeves and Davis, without a crew. And I wanted to get some more operations in. And I went to see our squadron commander and asked if I could find another pilot for us. And he did. I found a newcomer called Sergeant Lloyd Morgan. And he was completely new. I was a squadron navigation officer. But anyway, we went off and we made our first attack on, just a moment, let me get this right, on a place called Donge, D-O-N-G-E-S, which is on the north bank of the Loire. And that was important because it was a whole mass of oil tanks. I've even got a photograph of it now. It still exists. And it was very important to the Germans. If anything, the Germans were very short of oil. That was their Achilles heel. And we had to bomb these oil tanks. Nothing else but the oil tanks, which were a separate sort of unit on the north bank of the Loire. And we circled round, as usual, south of the target. And as we did so, and Reeves reported a night fighter coming at us. We took evasive action, and it would have been legitimate to have aborted the raid, but we didn't. We went in over the Loire, and the searchlights came on us, and the flak came up, and the night fighter disappeared. He didn't want to fly into his own flak. This was, I think, in many ways, the best raid I ever participated in, because it was a clear night and I could see those oil tanks absolutely spot on, and the stick of bombs fell slap across them, and they went up with a beautiful fire, absolutely beautiful. These flames in the sky, I could even see them from the back, you know. The oil tanks all went up. How many we hit, I don't know. But back we came, you see, and Roy Reeves was reporting these from the back. You know, we could see them from, I think, about 40 miles away, these oil tanks going up. And this was a legitimate target and a very, very good one. I think possibly the most effective one that I ever participated in. And then we had a day's rest and went off again. And this time we had to drop the bombs on the docks on a sort of island in the estuary of Nantes, again on the River Loire. And once more, we came in from the south. Once more, Reeves reported a night fighter having a go at us. Once more, Lloyd decided to go into the target. And once more, I dropped these bombs slap on the docks in the middle of this island. It was separated off with the river running both sides of it. And it was a very, very successful raid. And we came back. And this also was one of the main episodes where V flashes came to us. And this was reported in the Evening Standard. And Picture Post came down to photograph us because, I think, of these V thingies coming at us. And photographed all the chaps, and it was on the front of Picture Post with all these sergeants who saw these V things. I've still got the photographs here. And Lloyd got an immediate award of a DFM for that. But he's always been very, very modest about it. But it was quite right that he got it, I think, because he made the decision not to abort the raid and for us to go in and do it. And they were very, very effective raids indeed. So that's one thing which happened, I think, round about September 1941.
How is that decision made in the aircraft?
Well, on the first occasion, when we were over the sea, Percival decided to abort. He was quite, it was quite legitimate. I mean, the question was, should we continue and be shot down? But I suppose on this occasion, Morgan could have said abort the raid. He could have taken over from me on the approach and said abort the raid, and I would give them a... But I think we probably realised that if we got into the target, the night fighter wouldn't follow us. And it didn't on both occasions. We shook it off by flying into their own flak. And also, because we were down low, and he probably didn't like that very much, and they wanted to get underneath us with the Schrager Musica and fire into our belly. So those were other little episodes there. One other little thing that I didn't mention was coming back from one aborted raid. Not an aborted raid, a normal raid. The weather had completely closed in at St. Devil, and it really was bad. We circled around for some time, and then we were diverted to Boscombe Down in Wiltshire. Now, Boscombe Down was the experimental station. I'd never heard of it, actually, but I located it on the map, and we flew towards it. And we'd had a long trip, I think, somewhere down to La Police, and we hadn't got much fuel left. And fuel's getting lower and lower and lower. And I was getting worried. We hadn't seen anything since we left France. And the question was whether my navigation would be accurate enough to locate the target. And there was still cloud underneath us. And we were almost at the stage of clipping on our parachutes, because the only thing we could do was to climb up and bail out and hope for the best. And, you know, after maybe almost 2.5 hours without seeing land at all, and simply operating on dead reckoning, I wasn't too sure. Well, I made a terrible mistake and we were over the sea. But as it happened, we did come across these enormous new Drem landing lights at Boscombe Down. And we made an attack and came in. And landed there. Couldn't do anything about it. Couldn't get back to St. Devil. There was no hopeless. We stayed there overnight. And the first night I was there, the first day I was there, was this strange aircraft on the tarmac. I didn't know what it was. It was a Lancaster. And there was a friend of mine I remembered from training days, a navigator standing beside it. And I said, can I have a look in there? He said, no, no, you can't. It's secret. It was a secret development area, and it was the Lancaster being developed, which, of course, came into operation soon after that. Now, those are little things which arrived there. It's also worth mentioning that although there was strain there, there was also a fair amount of hilarity went on. It was strange because mixed up with the same type of men, we were to some extent laughing and joking together, even though the casualties were occurring. The squadron atmosphere wasn't too bad. We were, you know, we were young men with chaps of our own kind around us. We mixed up easily together, and we laughed and didn't go out very much. There wasn't occasion to go out. But we enjoyed each other's company, and even now when we meet again occasionally, we're very close together.
You had the job of squadron photographic officer that you've mentioned earlier on. What were your duties with that? What did that entail?
It didn't entail very much, because we very rarely carried cameras. They were very big ones, but I suppose I was there on the administrative work more than anything else, looking at the photographs which were developed. I looked at the photographs which were developed by photographic reconnaissance. I used to visit the photographic section quite. I took an interest in it and found out if there were any problems that should be resolved. And if there were, I'd report them to the right authorities and get something done about it. I was the squad. There was a station. There was a squadron photography officer. Later off in the war, I was a station photography officer as well. But that was my job. And to talk to the chaps doing the developing and printing. I liked doing it, and I've still got. I managed to acquire a lot of the photographs and take them away from with me, which I keep now. They're probably there in the original copies are probably there in the Imperial War Museum, but I've got my own efforts.
You were also station navigation officer.
Yes.
What does that entail?
Well, I made it my job to brief newcomers to the squadron about the hazards that they might encounter on the operational flights. And to some extent, when they were going off and we were going off to their to an operation and they were around, I would tell them something about what they might expect and advise them what to do. And they seemed to be very grateful about that. And if on occasions the CO had to fly, then he flew with me. Maybe on internal flights, you know, which weren't operational, occasionally you'd have to fly about from one station to another. I would fly the CO. I would discuss matters with the various commanders in the squadron, and if the squadron flew out, I would be in the leading aircraft always.
And you mentioned that you would pass on information. Is that in just generally how you would do things, or, you know, the threats that they would face?
I would advise them what to do if a night fighter attacked us. I'd advise them, as I say, how to come into and get the hell out of it as quickly as they could, keep down low over the sea, coming back after leaving the target, keep down low until you felt it was safe enough to climb up to 300 feet, or if you were going over the Brittany Peninsula, you climb up to 3,000 feet, over the sea maybe 1,500 feet, but keep down low as soon as you left the target. Little things which didn't come into the briefing.
It's interesting because your explanation of that is that's not your experience when you joined the squadron, was it?
I had none of that. I had to acquire that myself. But I was a very diligent sort of chap who would try to find out about these things, partly to do my job well and partly to ensure that I survived.
Is it somewhat as well partly a change in ethos, do you think, in the Air Force at that time, that a lot of people were coming into it and starting on operations like yourself who had not necessarily had a career in the RAF, and that you had a different outlook? Would that be?
Well, I think they would have had, the ones following me would have had gone through OTU, but they would not have known about the specific circumstances in our squadron and the little tips which could be given them. I told them that if they were ever shot down, that they would try to get to Marseille and try to find who was called the English captain. You had to ask for the English captain when you got there. I found that out. And the English captain, it was in Vichy, France. I knew that I learned somehow or another that you had to ask anybody who looked friendly enough, where is the English captain? Now, the English captain would have made arrangements to get us off the mountains into Spain with suitable guides, and this did happen occasionally, not in our squadron, but with other chaps who were flying over France. I don't know who the English captain was, but that's what he was called. He was probably a Frenchman, actually, if the truth were known, who was sympathetic towards the RAF and had some knowledge of the RAF. Anyway, whatever current information I could. In other words, these weren't things which were told to me when I got into the squadron, but I felt it advisable to relay to newcomers.
And the point when you came off operations but you remained with the squadron, what type of duties were you doing then?
Helping the squadron adjutant. Admin work, very largely, and to some extent, although I was no longer the squadron navigation officer, it was taken over by somebody else because who was operationally flying. I was still able to. I can remember on occasions even trying to get a crew together to fly when I thought I ought to, but I never did. And I was also, to some extent, I suppose, involved on the intelligence side too. I thought the best thing they could do with me was to send me to group headquarters. But no, they wanted me to be an instructor, and they were probably right.
Were you aware that you would, when you came off operations, that you would have to go to a training or an administrative role?
Yes, and I was left on the squadron before the course started. I remained in the squadron until the next course started.
So when was that, and where did you go to?
Well, I went to number 2 instructor's course at RF Craneage in Cheshire, and was taught how to teach.
Can you give me an idea of how they did that?
Yes. I was, it was part flying, but mostly ground. And I wasn't looking forward to it. I didn't want to be an instructor. But when I got there, I realised that what they were telling me was of enormous advantage on the instruction side. We were taught, first of all, that we were not, that we had to write on the blackboard. We had to write on the blackboard in a certain way. There had to be no loops. Everything had to be up and down strokes or round strokes. That we had to put, first of all, as we came in, we had to write the subject matter on the board in clear, large letters. We had to rotate the chalk when we were doing it so that everything was clearly visible. We had to address the class in a certain way. We were not allowed to fix our eyes on one particular part of the classroom. We had to keep looking round the classroom as we talked. We were not allowed to talk for more than 2 minutes in a stretch. We had to, after that, we had to put a summary of what we'd said on the blackboard, then talk for another 2 minutes, then put it on the blackboard again. We had to simplify our language as much as possible. We had to raise our heads and deliver the language. We were not allowed to have any peculiarities, such as jingling keys in our pockets. And it didn't matter what the subject matter was, whether it was aviation or anything else, and some of these chaps were civilians who were teaching us, this is the way we had to do it. We were not allowed to talk for more than half an hour, and the rest of the time was to be occupied on questions and answers. And I took to this. We also had to give talks on stupid subjects. I had to get up and give, using the techniques, half an hour's talk on a matchbox. That was my subject matter, on a matchbox. And I had to deliver, using this method, in certain ways, that projected it to the people involved. And it worked. oddly enough, when I became an instructor, it did work. And it also, many years later, I used to teach at a university crammar and teach on subjects of which I had very little knowledge. But using these methods by mugging up a bit beforehand and delivering it, and if you asked an awkward question afterwards, you say, well, that's very interesting. It's going to be the subject of our next lecture.